out of the frying pan into the very same identical frying pan. I'm not sure this actually buys us anything.
Listeners, and welcome to episode number 71 of Bad Voltage, which is, once again, not all four of us, which is a little bit sad, but we are without Brian today.
It was a last minute thing.
Some last minute stuff come up. We did think we had all four of us, but so we did have one show with all four of us there, and then right back to shenanigans, I guess. But despite that fact, we have an action-packed show full of consternation and Stuart being nervous for the future, basically. But what are we going to talk about today?
All right, so we're going to talk about Brexit, this big vote that just happened recently about whether Britain is going to be in or out of Europe, and it turns out that out was the decision. We're going to get into that for a bumper segment, which will be kind of a discussion and / interview with Ack about this as well, as resident native.
On a more technical note, we were asked the question, when is it right to open source a project or a piece of software? And we're going to drill down a bit into why you'd make that decision, what motivates it, and where you go with it.
And then the inverse of the bumper Brexit segment is going to be, we're going to get into Snappy and Flatpak, and we're going to try and talk about it for 5 minutes just to kind of dip our toes in the discussion. We can do that because Brian's not here, so we can have a conversation for about 5 minutes with the idea of kicking off a discussion so all of you folks can weigh in, and then maybe we'll get back into it in a couple of weeks' time.
Spoiler alert, even without Brian, we failed miserably at the five-minute thing.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we're terrible. So.
But despite that, and now, Bad Voltage.
So, unless you've been living under a rock, you may have seen that the populace of Great Britain and United Kingdom has decided to leave the EU in a referendum in what people are calling Brexit. I'd be interested to hear thoughts from you chaps about how this stuff is perceived from abroad. I mean, this has been the most tumultuous couple of weeks in politics I have ever experienced by quite some distance. You may find there was more stuff like this in kind of the early 80s and things, but given that I was busy watching Danger Mouse and not really caring about what Militant were doing at that point, I don't remember it. But this has been...
It's been quite nice, though, because it's made American politics look normal for a week.
It has been a refreshing change from our... So I think we have an interesting perspective here. Oh, go ahead.
Like I said, the thing I find most annoying about it is that I no longer have this massive moral political high ground when talking to Americans. Because before, someone would say, oh, British politics, but there's all these problems. And you go, well, yeah, but at least we're not going to elect Donald Trump, eh? Ho, 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 stupid yank. And now I've totally lost that argument because now we're worse. I mean, I went to New York. Wasn't on the last show because I was in New York, which is fabulous, by the way, right? Load of great restaurants. Go there if you get a chance. And we spent the first couple of days, myself and Neve, wandering around the city, and we'd go in places to like buy a postcard and some stamps, and the guy would sell us some stamps, and then he'd say, by the way, what's going on in Britain? I'd be like, dude, shut up, I'm on holiday to get away from this stuff. while attempting to stop in every single cafe on Fifth Avenue so I could get Wi-Fi and find out what was happening in the news.
I think everybody who I've met in the last 2 weeks has asked me about what I think about Brexit as well.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to say. I think we have an interesting perspective out of the three of us because we have one person born in the UK, stayed in the UK, one person born in the UK, now lives in the United States, and one person born in the United States and still in the United States. So I think we're hitting it from a bunch of different angles. So I'm kind of curious what the three of us think too, because I'm sure there's a lot of misinformation, I'm sure, going around in Britain, but the media that we're getting, I'm sure, is even layered on top of that worse. So
what do you think, Jeremy? So, why don't we start this conversation out on the right footing with facts, which is usually what you bring.
As an American, before we get into facts, I think the one thing that shocked me about this is that such a major decision came through as a referendum and just required a simple majority and not a two-thirds supermajority, so that you could have 0.0001% of the population vote something and have such a massive change is deeply troubling to me, and just an odd choice.
Referenda here are rare. There have been a few in my lifetime, but not that many. There was this one. There was the one on moving to proportional voting a few years ago. The original decision to join the EU in the 70s was done by referendum, but there really aren't that many. And as far as I'm aware, every time there's been a referendum, it's been simple majority. The idea of a two-thirds majority referendum just flat doesn't exist here.
Which seems odd to me, because what it was, 51.9 to 48.1 with 72.2% turnout, is that right?
Yeah.
Certainly
the figures were roughly that, and I suspect you're reading them off a screen rather than having counted them yourself, so I'm prepared to believe them, but yes, they were. But yes, that's where it was. It was about three quarters turnout, and there was about 3-4% in it.
So the one thing that the media here continually kind of played is there was one younger female saying, well, I voted for it, but I didn't think it would pass. I was just kind of voting for it. And they played a bunch of, they replayed that specific one many times. She was in a train station. I don't know if they showed that one over there. But they seemed, the insinuation in the American media seems to have been that a lot of people were either directly lied to, as like that $350 million NHS bus thing, or kind of were voting against it because they didn't want to accept to pass by too much because they didn't want it to be seen as kind of a mandate, but they did want to accept to pass. And so coming from the UK side, is that, would you say that's accurate or no?
There are two separate issues in that. On the point of that clip and a bunch of similar clips like it, the idea that a lot of people who voted for Leave didn't really expect to win and were quite shocked when they did win, and if they'd known they were going to win, they might not have voted. That's obviously a very appealing thing to hear for the 48.1% of people who voted Remain. And I believe there is a whole bunch of buyer's regret on the side of Remain voters who now think, huh, if I'd have known we were going to crater the pound and the world economy, completely sod everything up and destroy our position in the world, maybe I wouldn't have voted for it. However, I do not think there's as much buyer's regret as we were perhaps hoping 2 hours after the results came out. Separately to that, there is a big issue around whether people voted Leave because they were misled by the Leave campaign. Were people misled by the Leave campaign? Absolutely. As far as I can tell, it was a farrago of lies from top to bottom. Whether people voted for it on that basis, and then when those lies were revealed, those people said, I would have changed my vote if I'd have known the truth, is entirely a different question.
So, silly question, right? Because I have to admit, until
such thing as silly questions. Go on.
Until the month or two before, probably the month before the vote, I wasn't really keeping up with what was going on. And from what I understand, as with everything in politics, you had two polarized groups of people. Right. So the Remainers were very different philosophically to the Leavers. And from what I understand, the way the Remainers were pegging the Leavers was that this is a pretty xenophobic platform, right? Is that the reason why we want to get out of Europe is because of immigration is out of control, right? Is that correct? Would you say that that was the primary platform was based upon immigration?
There are quite a lot of separate things in that question, so I'm going to retract my earlier statement. There are such things as silly questions. No, that's unfair. Okay, so taking them one at a time. Are there a bunch of Remainers who are saying that people voted Leave because they're motivated essentially by racism? Yes, there are a bunch of Remainers saying that. Is what they're saying the truth? Are there a bunch of Leave people who are motivated by racism? Are there some? Obviously, there always will be in any election. Most of the people who would say, who voted Leave and would say they have concerns about immigration, would vociferously deny that it's because they hate Polish people.
Right. Yeah.
Whether they're telling the truth or not, it's... I have a tiny little bit of sympathy for Leave voters, because if you think that the level of immigration in the UK is problematic... But that's not because you hate Polish people. It's just because you think public services are overwhelmed. It's very hard right. to make that case without sounding like the most unbelievable racist on the face of the earth.
Well, that's kind of what I'm getting towards, is that everything... So when the vote went down, the vast majority of people who I follow on Twitter and on social media and stuff like that were obviously voting Remain. And when the vote went down... The response was, this is a bunch of, essentially, this is a xenophobic decision. It was very much about race, and it was about immigration, was the primary response. But I want you to just check whether that was the common viewpoint in England and in Great Britain, or whether that was just the people I'm following.
Is it the common viewpoint among people who voted Remain in England? I would say most people who voted Remain would say that at least some of the reason why people voted Leave is not rational concerns about immigration, it's because they're a closet racist.
Right.
Is that actually the truth? I don't know. And by definition, it can't be the majority opinion in England, because the majority opinion in England is voting to Leave. That's why they won the referendum. So,
right. What seemed kind of interesting to me in watching the campaign kind of unfold is that the Leave side, at least from my perspective in the clips that I saw, which is obviously going to be a little more limited over here, is that the Leave side had very little factual information. It seemed to be, we need to take control back. That's the one quote we kept hearing over here, is we need to take control back. We don't have control. Brussels is out of control. So that seemed to be one of the major themes. And it was... Like, one of the quotes was, well, we're sick of experts with acronyms telling us what's right for our country. So we there seemed to be a big anti-intellectualism on that side of the campaign, which kind of mirrors what's happening in the United States in a lot of ways, is there's definitely some anti-intellectualism going on one side of the argument. Where do you think that stems from? And I think, because interestingly with the Brexit model, or however you want to, how it came down on Leave versus Remain, there's a lot of parallels to the right versus the left in current American politics, I think, which is interesting.
Yeah, very much so.
I think it would be reasonable to say, and, you know, painting my own bias here, I am hardcore Remain voter, right?
This is really quite clear.
Unlike the rest of Birmingham, because Birmingham voted to Leave, correct?
Yeah.
It was basically like London, Scotland, and Northern Ireland were heavy, heavy Remain,
Little tiny bit of clarification here. Birmingham is big city. My bit of Birmingham, Ladywood, voted to Remain. 2-1.
Gotcha. Oh,
however,
you live in a place called Ladywood?
I do.
I just wanted to dwell on that for a moment. Carry on. Anyway.
I do. Great place. Ladywood covers the city centre, essentially, and Edgbaston. A whole bunch of other bits of Birmingham voted Leave 2-1. And we've seen a whole bunch of people drawing correlations between things like education and the way you voted. And possibly it's true that people who are better educated voted to Remain and people who are less well educated voted to Leave and so on. But a lot of these things, they're clearly pushing a political agenda by doing that survey. And therefore, it's difficult to... It plays into the audience that they're pitching it to. You know, right. So I read something like that and I think, you see. But then there are a bunch of stuff on the other side. The point Jerry makes about anti-intellectualism is an interesting one. I think the difference between the UK and the US, say 5 years ago, is that I think here there was quite a feeling that it didn't really matter who you voted for. You basically got a choice between two centre-right parties. Right? It didn't matter if you voted Tory, you got the blue Tories, and if you voted Labour, you got the red Tories, but they're all essentially the same. And from a technological point of view, digital rights point of view, both parties were in favour of being able to do things like read your email and ban encryption and what have you. People actually heavily invested in politics would say, no, there's a huge amount of difference between them, and look what they're doing with the NHS, completely different and so on. But there was a pervasive feeling on the streets that it didn't really matter. Whoever you voted for, you got the same bunch of besuited, Eton-attending politicians that we've always had, which is what I think supported the rise of Jeremy Corbyn, because he's emphatically not drawn from that political class. And I think the sensation of we don't want to listen to experts is because it's very easy to point to everything that's gone wrong in the last 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years and say, well, all those decisions were advised by experts because by definition they were. And then say, you see, all that stuff has gone wrong. Experts advised us, and what did we get? The credit crunch. Therefore, experts are not all they're cracked up to be. And I think that's not only a very easy, if facile, argument to make, but it's also quite a compelling argument. I mean, I occasionally find myself thinking precisely that. For God's sake, you know, we get advice from all these people, and what happened? And it didn't get any better, did it? Maybe we should try something else. And I think that's what that's playing into. And the Donald on your side of the ocean and the Leave campaign on this side both did quite a good job of tapping into that vein of anti-intellectualism, which is really anti-establishment more than anything else. Because if you're a non-establishment expert, then you're basically a bloke who shouts in the pub, right? All experts are establishment, otherwise you wouldn't know about them. So I think anti-intellectualism is actually really anti-establishment. When I say Trump and Leave both did a good job of that, what I mean is they did a terribly evil job of it, but a very efficient job of it.
Well, it seems as well that the thing with the Leave side and with Trump is they just, it's easier in many ways for them because they can tap into the fear that people have got, right?
Yeah.
They can build this fear that that other people will come out and say, no, but here's the facts that prove that that's not the case. And people may say, well, yeah, but that doesn't really get to the heart of the fear. So you're always going to have this dark halo that hovers above what's going on.
Well,
for some people, particularly people who are of an older generation, and particularly people who are, a little bit xenophobic, you know, they're going to, irrespective of what the facts say, they're going to kind of go in that direction.
Well, facts don't make good sound bites, right? So that's part of it.
No. And that's an interesting point, I think. That if you look at the stuff the Leave campaign was saying, a lot of what was promised was flat out incorrect. It's not like, you know, this is a complicated question, here's our view on it. Not only things like the £350 million a week written on the side of a bus, which they all then went, no, we never said that, right? That's not the truth. We never claimed that would be the case. You're like, dude, who's a picture of you with it written on a bus right behind you? and leaving aside the fact that they managed to make the referendum essentially be a proxy vote on immigration, what I'm interested in is the idea of flat-out lying to people. Things like suggesting that it's possible to approach the EU and say, right, we want a free trade treaty, but we don't want any of the free movement stuff, with the idea that the EU will go, okay, that sounds like a good idea, which is just not going to happen. But the Leave campaign actively misled people by saying, yeah, we can do that, which again plays into that feeling of, yeah, we're important, we're Great Britain, we can do that because we're important. From an American politics point of view, how much of what's being said is actually lies, but lies that people want to hear?
You mean as in the way that this whole thing has been presented over here?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the stuff Trump saying, a lot of what he's saying is like, I'm going to build a wall around the country and whatever, which, you know, isn't a lie. It might be a bad idea and he might not actually get to do it, but it's not actively misleading the populace. Whereas if he said, I'm going to... I'm going to imprison all Mexicans, right? Which is actually a lie. He's not going to do that because the Constitution doesn't let him.
Right.
If he stood up and said that, but people went, "Huh," but I'd like to see that happen.
I think the thing that's interesting about him is that caliber of
direct untruth, but that people want you to be able to do, even if you're not allowed, so they vote for you without thinking that's not going to happen.
So he objectively,
American politics.
He objectively lies quite a bit if you look at nonpartisan sites that track factual information. The thing that's interesting, right, I think, specifically about Trump is he's so contradictory that it's difficult to tell when he's lying because he contradicts himself all of the time.
Yeah.
He says so many vastly different things.
If we had Brian here, he'd say, do you know how you can tell when Trump is lying? His lips are moving. So
the thing is, as well as, I mean, I follow PolitiFact, which, from what I can tell, do a reasonable job of checking for facts in political discourse. And it seems like, from what I can tell, both sides lie all the time. Right, the amount of time someone says something and PolitiFact comes out and says, yeah, this is pants on fire, like, this is just, you know, this is not true. I think the difference with Trump is, like Jeremy says, he just contradicts himself constantly. Like Hillary, I don't think contradicts herself as much, but she does tell a lot of porkies. So I'd say they're all lying all the time, pretty much. Right. But Trump is just so outrageously inconsistent in the way that he
talks. The other thing that amazes me about, you listen to some of the Trump speeches, he will talk for 10 minutes and legitimately say nothing. It's almost astonishing how he can just string words together that when you break it down, he just said nothing at all. Which is it's fascinating. But so this is probably going to end up being a long topic because there's a bunch of questions. I know I still have it. I don't know about you, Jono, but it's what? So.
Do
you think
I got one more? I just wanted to dip into, and we can. I guess we can go along on this. I mean, it's a freaking podcast, right?
Yeah.
So
we're not going to run out of bits on the internet. I don't think there's still quite a few of them out there.
So I found this whole Brexit thing a little bit difficult to process because, like everything, like pretty much with everything, I'm usually down the middle. Like, I see validity in both sides of the argument and I see buffoonery in both sides of the argument. So I often sympathize with both sides. As an example, like my parents, my mum voted to leave, my dad voted to remain, right? So I've talked with them quite a bit about this as well. And this argument that that I've seen in the general kind of ether that part of the reason why people want to leave is because of this immigration thing, is that people are flooding into the UK and oversubscribing the services such as the NHS and whatever else. Ack, from your perspective, and Jeremy, if you've, because you're the fact meister on Bad Voltage, like, is there any validity to that? Because I get the fear of it. I get why people may worry. And I also get the notion, right? Like, if you have a European state and you have free travel, then arguably people could go to the places that offer the best, you know, compendium of services. But what I don't know is whether the reality of that is the case. Are lots of people flooding into England and nicking NHS time or whatever else? Like, what have you guys seen about that?
Two separate parts of that question, which are, is it happening? And will voting to leave stop it happening if it is?
Right.
Taking the latter one first, leaving the EU will stop free movement of people into the UK, certainly. But the instant we want all the free trade stuff back, we're going to get all the free movement stuff back as well. So it's not going to actually affect anything. We either materially damage the UK's trade policy or we get all that free movement stuff. Which means that nothing is going to change, which is,
right, I mean, one of the things they keep saying is that they're going to join the European Economic Area, which I guess for those not familiar with, it's separate from the EU, but you need all four free movements to get in, right? Freedom of goods, freedom of services, money, and people. So if you break out of the EU at least this is my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you break out of the EU and then join the European Economic Area, your payment in would be almost the same. You'd have to follow the majority of the regulations and laws, but you would now have no way to influence any of those regulations and laws.
Correct.
So in that situation...
Eloquently and excellently put.
Quick clarifying question about that then. So if England or the UK joined that, would that essentially mean the same level of free movement?
Yes.
So as it was beforehand?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
So it's kind of like Norway is now, right?
Yes. Norway is the thing that people have heard of, which is in the EEA. And they have, exactly as Jeremy says, being part of the EEA means that you embrace pretty much the rules that the EU puts on you. So you have to have free movement of people, you have to have free movement of goods and so on. Then you get access to all the free trade, we can trade with you. You don't need visas to travel around, sort of thing. But okay. You have to buy into all the EU rules. But if you're part of the EEA, you don't get to elect MEPs, members of the European Parliament, who then enforce and embody and change those rules. Okay?
And you're allowed into many of the meetings, but not all of them. Like the security meetings, you have to leave.
Yeah.
This
There is an additional point to that, which is you can't just rock up and go, I want to be in the EEA and pay your membership and then they have to let you in, right? It's not like a nightclub. And there is a very real chance that we'll go and say, we want to join the EEA. And the people who vote on it will go, no. And we'll say, why not? And they say, because you people hate the EU and are really mean about us. Go fuck yourselves. Right?
I think there's too much money involved for that to happen.
We're under
I think
no
if they
obligation
apply,
to do... well, there's... I don't know much about European politics, but if it's anything like any other politics I've seen, both on a, you know, a geopolitical nation-state scale and on smaller things, an awful lot of it runs on people doing one another favours, a certain amount of interpersonal relationships, old boys' networks, whatever. And we have defiantly burned every one of those bridges. So showing up and asking for anything other than the most work-to-rule mean consideration is going to result in us getting a knockback, because they are under, not only are they under no obligation to do us any favours, they're under no inclination to do so either.
And I think there's a certain incentive in Brussels to make sure that they... Punish is probably not the right word, but make it as difficult as they can just to disincent other countries from trying to get out of the EU, like Italy or
Spain.
Absolutely.
Not a phrase they actually use in France, pour encourager les autres, despite it being said by Voltaire, of all people. But yes, they want to discourage people from leaving the EU, and the way to do that is to find someone who tried to leave the EU and then push them into a volcano, which annoyingly happens to be us.
Right. So two final questions before we wrap it up. There was a bunch of petitions I see going around, including one of them that was actually set up by leavers before the referendum passed, asking for a second referendum vote. And the one that was before just said if the whatever side wins, if it wins by less than 60% or turnout is less than 75%, there should be a second referendum. Do you think there will be a second referendum? You do. Because Theresa May said, I'm very clear that Brexit vote gave us a very clear message from the people that we can't allow freedom of movement to continue. Brexit means
now,
Brexit.
Now, hang on.
That's a direct quote that I am reading off the screen.
Do I think there will be a second referendum? I honestly don't know. There haven't been people leaving before, but in EU referenda generally... The EU have known form with making countries do a referendum again until the right answer comes out, right? It's happened in Ireland, it's happened in, I forget, well, somewhere else, right? So the idea of continually redoing a referendum until the answer the EU wants comes out is not, you know, unknown.
And it seems to me that the second referendum would be a lot different because most of the leaders of Leave have quit.
Indeed, they have.
Or left in some way. So it seems to me that the face of the...
They have left. Ho, ho, right. ho. Although Nigel Farage is an example, he's still drawing his salary as an MEP.
It's a nice gig.
Makes me die, honestly. The irony avalanche in this whole thing, I just can't cope with it. Do I think there will be a second referendum is another question. It would be flagrantly in defiance of the majority of the people who voted. And Theresa May, who has, who is now going to be Prime Minister, Cameron has left today. Theresa May has, as you say, stood up and said, no, Brexit means Brexit. This is what we're going to do. There are a bunch of tricky legal things that people could, if it was decided that a second referendum should happen, there are a bunch of technical legal ways you could make it happen. But in practice, I don't think Theresa May is going to do it unless she fundamentally reverses her position.
Because she was a tacit Remainer, correct? But pretty tacit.
Yes. Pretty tacit. The whole damn thing was pretty tacit. But part of Cameron, much as I dislike the bloke, and he did have sex with a pig at one point, he did quite a neat job of getting himself out of the hot seat. Because at some point, fine, so we go through with this and we sign Article 50. Someone has to actually show up at the EU with that piece of paper in their hand and go, here you go, we're out. Catch you later, Bill and Ted. That person lives on in the history books forever as the person who took Britain out of the EU, because here's a picture of them doing it. And David Cameron did not want it to be him. Right. It's now possible it's going to be Theresa May, and the idea of being elected Prime Minister and also being a sacrificial lamb at the same point astounds me. Yeah. But nonetheless, it may happen.
I have one last question to kind of end it on a completely different note, and it's something that I kind of haven't, at least on this side of the pond, heard talked about quite as much, is do you think the EU will be weaker without Britain? Because if you look at how the EU is kind of structured now, you have a bunch of countries which are pretty left-leaning, pretty pro-regulation. And then since the beginning of when the EU joined, they were kind of bolted on the side in a weird way. They're much more pro, I would say, open markets. They're much more laissez-faire in general in their government. And in a lot of things, they were a counterbalance to the entire rest of the EU on some policies. So do you think without that voice, if the UK left, the EU will somewhat ironically end up being weaker and that there'd be more of a hive mind to the entire EU now?
Do I think the EU will be weaker? I don't. Britain is reasonably important country and is visible globally, and being outside rather than inside the EU is going to make the EU worse because it's missing that voice. Do I think that it's necessarily a problem the EU becomes more left-leaning? No, not really, speaking as a left-wing person. But I do think it will make the EU weaker. But then that's why everyone in the EU said, please don't leave, we don't want you to. Right. So, yes, I think nobody is better off by this decision. People who voted leave, I am quite prepared to accept ignoring the you're closet racist charge. I do think that the referendum was essentially a proxy referendum on immigration, and I don't think they're going to get what they want. I think immigration levels are going to stay exactly as they are now because we're going to end up accepting all the free movement clauses. So it's not going to fix things for them. It's made things materially worse for Remainers. I have never experienced a day of despair about politics more than that Friday. It was miserable. The EU are going to be worse off because of it, and the rest of the world are going to be worse off because of it, not least of which because the pound is one of the major benchmark currencies, and it's gone in the toilet. Annoyingly enough, just before I went to New York. Did I think to change money before that? No, I didn't. So I'm sitting there, 2 o'clock in the morning, just as the votes start coming in, the morning of the Friday, and I thought, and watching the graphs dropping on the news and thinking, oh my God, I need dollars. So off I go to the post office website where I normally change money, and you go to the change money bit and click on I want to change pounds into dollars, and there's a big notice up which says, due to the volatility in the markets, currency exchange is closed. And I thought, you bastards, honestly. So I took like a 10% haircut on the amount of dollars I had to change. I was genuinely irritated about it. You know, leaving aside the whole, you know, this, what does this mean for the future of Britain and the future of the European project and, you know, the world as a whole. Speaking on a purely personal level, I got to go to probably one less restaurant in New York than I would have wanted to just because it cost more money. Annoyed.
You know what, though? It sucks. But it'll all bounce back. Yeah, the world will move on. The world will march on. So, but it does suck. I mean, there's no doubt about it. So
it does.
Anyway, I'd love to hear what the Bad Voltage community think about this. Go to the forum, let us know, community.badvoltage.org, because I'm sure that we'll have a vigorous debate.
I am
genuinely interested to hear from Leave voters. Not people who not Remain voters who can see why they would have voted Leave or right. accept the arguments for it. Someone who says, I voted Leave and these are my reasons. I would ask the rest of the Bad Voltage community, myself included, to not basically accuse them of being Hitler if someone does say that.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
I'm especially nice. Curious to hear from people in the Bad Voltage community who are in the EU, or in the UK, I'm sorry, and regardless of what, if you voted Leave and are old enough that you originally voted to join the EU, I'm curious from people, because a lot of the older generation are people who voted the UK into the EU. So yes, I'm curious from anyone who voted to join originally and leave, because I'm curious
I'd be very interested to hear from such people. I have spoken to a bunch of those people, but they're my parents and my parents' friends and so on. The Evo happened before I was born, so I don't remember it. But yes, I would call upon people to make this a sensible debate. Right, don't accuse people of being Nazis. It doesn't help.
There's been a lot of discussion recently about Snappy and Flatpak, these two new next generation packaging tools for Linux, and we're going to kick off a segment which is going to be a 5-minute challenge. Can we actually talk about this in 5 minutes and get out of this within 5 minutes? I'm not confident that we can, because, you know, we tend to ramble on a bit, as you've already noticed in this show. So what do we think about Snappy and Flatpak? I mean, they seem to be two very similar, they're solving very similar problems, but they're somewhat different approaches. What do you guys think about it?
Do you think they're solving very similar problems? Because it seems like Flatpak, which is really XDG app, is really just aimed at the desktop, right? It needs desktop sessions. It's kind of a different thing than Snappy, which is not necessarily aimed at desktop questions. So I think they're trying to solve slightly different problems, right? Or no?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. Flatpak is, optimized at the desktop. Snappy is a more generic thing. So the plan is to use it for IoT devices and for servers and for the desktop and phones and all the same thing.
And so it sounds like you guys are a little bit more familiar with both of these. So just for the listeners, and I know we only have 5 minutes, so I'm going to be really quick on this, have kind of an idea. Let me make sure I'm getting this correctly. So snaps, right, are basically static. They have everything that is required to run it is in a singular snap. All of the dependencies, all of everything, where Flatpak has more of a concept of shared libraries where you have to declare a runtime, and the runtimes are actually on the system, not in the Flatpak. And then you say this Flatpak requires these runtimes and go from there. Is that correct?
Basically,
requires Wayland and SE Linux and C groups, whereas Snap is AppArmor and some other stuff. Correct?
Yes, it's essentially correct. So if you build a Flatpak of something, you say it depends on GNOME as a whole. But instead of being the very detailed kind of Debian level, these 52 packages in these 52 version numbers, it's a much higher level, as you say, what Flatpak calls runtime. You say, I depend on this version of GNOME, and then you get it. Snappy, everything goes into it. Now, there is talk about Snappy frameworks, which are essentially that. Large dependencies where you've only got one of them on the system rather than others. But how you've described it is essentially the truth. Yes.
Yep.
And how do you think this is going to play out then?
The question is going to be adoption on either side, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, which one is going to be adopted the most? Canonical have gone out vigorously to get Snappy integrated into other distributions, that journey is beginning. I've seen less of it on the Flatpak side, mainly because I think they were just kind of chugging along until Snappy came along, and now suddenly everyone's talking about Flatpak as well. But I guess the question is like, which one of these is going to be able to be the most general purpose interest to everybody? And I don't know. I think it's all to play for, personally. There's a certain amount of, people camping out into either camp. Like, some people are just rabidly Snappy and some rabidly Flatpak. But I think it's kind of too early to tell at this point, in my mind.
I think this is going to play out the same way Wayland and Mir has, in that Canonical have built a thing and they're going to use it. And a bunch of and everyone else won't use that thing, largely because it comes from Canonical. So they end up separate. And I think that will increase Ubuntu's differentiation from the rest of desktop Linux. But you think that's a good thing or a bad thing? But right. I think the idea that you will be able to say, okay, I want to download this thing, this piece of software, I'll go to their website and I'll get the Linux package and that will work on Ubuntu and on other things, is a hopeless pipe dream at this point. The idea that you might be able to go there and say, I'll get this package and it works on Fedora and SUSE and Debian is a possibility, I think. But the idea that Ubuntu right. will be in that list is unlikely. I can imagine a world in which Ubuntu starts shipping the Flatpak runtime stuff as part of the desktop. I can imagine a world in which other distributions start shipping Snapd as part of their desktop. But the idea that a third-party developer will be able to say, I'll just pick one and do that and that covers everybody, is not going to happen, in my opinion.
Well, it depends on the scope of the distributions as well. Like whether it's all distributions or whether it's the main ones like Ubuntu and Debian and Fedora and whatever. The one thing that I think is going to need to happen is there is already, I think, Canonical is going to have to work extra hard to build bridges to make this happen. I think that this work has got good intentions with Snappy, but because of all the drama that's gone down previously with Unity and other bits and pieces, Canonical is going to need to really kind of pedal to build those relationships with these other distributions and work really closely with them to make it happen effectively. Because it would be a shame if, like, Snappy seems pretty cool to me. It would be a shame if grudges from the past block the ability for people to build good stuff with Snappy.
Well,
and I hope that doesn't happen.
I'm interested, Jeremy, you're much more in touch with, as part of LQ, much more in touch with a whole range of Linux distros. Mm-hmm. What's the view from people who aren't directly invested in this?
Well, it's clear that neither of these have any kind of mainstream adoption from what I can tell. The Flatpak installation is still ridiculously complicated if they want to. It's early days for both, I think, is a good way to put it. Because if you look at, I read an article where someone tried to install LibreOffice using Flatpak, Snappy, and AppImage. Snappy for LibreOffice didn't work even on Ubuntu. Flatpak LibreOffice didn't work even on Fedora. AppImage actually worked on both, but if you can't get it to work on your own distribution, I don't know that it's even worth talking about yet long term, because they still have a long way to go to do even very basic stuff on their own distribution. So I think it's clear that everyone agrees that we need something like this. I'm kind of curious how this will play out, because it seems like Flatpak is very heavily Fedora based. Snappy is obviously very heavily Canonical based. You know, and Brian's not here to bring this up, but it seems like Canonical tried very hard in the press release to make it seem like it was included in every distribution, and maybe that's not the case. I'm sure he'll want to talk about that in the next show or at some point in the future. So, long term, I'm not sure.
In the next show.
Hey,
we're at 7 minutes and 19 seconds. We already failed. All right. So, let's wrap it up. Go and let us know what you think, everyone. We're keeping this pretty short. Maybe we can revisit it next time with Brian, see what he thinks. And we suck at doing things in 5 minutes.
We got an email from a chap called Tobias Schoenberg. And he he asked us to look at a particular question. So this is what he said. He said, I'd be interested in you discussing the circumstances under which it makes or does not make sense to be or become open sourced. He gives an example of JRebel, which is not open. And he says that's it's fine because it's such an easy to use tool. If they wanted to make it free as in speech, they'd have to make it free as in beer. And then they probably couldn't pay their developers. Red Hat, everything is open source, question mark. But then they have a lot of tremendously complicated stuff. So by open sourcing it all, they actually promote their paid support services. GitHub isn't open source. So there's a question there about if you've got a product or you've built some software, when do you open source it and why? And what's the motivations behind doing so?
Yeah. It's a really interesting question. Thanks, Tobias, for writing in.
It is.
My gut feeling here is that it depends. It sounds like Tobias's question is assuming that there's a company behind it. Because there is separately the question of, like, if you have a project that you're working on in your spare time, do you open source it or do you not open source it? And I would say in both circumstances, whether you're a company or whether you're an individual, it's looking at the benefits of what you're going to get out of that. Like, open sourcing it for the ethical purposes, which is more of a free software argument, is a separate thing. There are some people who believe that basically all software should be completely free, which I think we all sympathize with, but to varying levels of severity. But to me, like, what are the benefits from open sourcing it? And what are the risks of it as well? Like, if you open source something, you will get... To me, the code in many ways is the artifact. The thing that you really need to build is the community and the engagement and the developer base.
Who would have thought that John O'Bacon, community manager, thinks the community is the important thing? Goodness me. Speaking as a developer, however.
Because there are a lot of people who open source something and they throw it out there and then they don't, you know, they basically commit all of their code out there and it doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
So like, and I think there is actually a big misconception around that. A lot of people don't understand that, you know, open sourcing something is actually the easy bit.
Right.
Like, but how you get people involved and excited and participate and make them feel welcome is really hard.
Well, I was going to say, I think if you're going to do a single code dump, throw it over the wall, and then that's it, you probably shouldn't open source it because it's probably not going to be beneficial.
Well, here's the thing. I agree with everything you've said, and if you want to build a viable project and build a community around it, you can't open sourcing it by going, here is a tarball, and then never speaking to anyone again does not help accomplish that. However, there is something else that open source does, and code dumps do help with that, which is it's one of the things where, ideally, if you're running a company, you want what's good for the company and what's good for the community and the users to be the same thing, right? Then there's no incentive to do things which users don't like because it's better for your company. But right. One of the things which, by definition, is bad for the company behind the project and by definition is good for the users behind the project is to allow the users to go somewhere else which provides the same service. Right? That is right. Almost always a good thing for users that they're not explicitly tied to your project. And it's almost always a bad thing for the company because you're enabling your competitors. But open sourcing code is a very user-friendly thing to do. It means that as a company, you are declaring, we can't lock you in, because if we're too mean, one of you will just spin this up as a server somewhere else and all of our customers will leave. So it helps to redress that balance a bit between what's good for the company and what's good for the users.
That's an intellectual case.
I was going to say kind of, because if you just do a single code dump and don't get a community, no one's going to have the expertise in your product to do that spin up.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I know, but exactly. do you not think if you take GitHub as an example, if GitHub were to stand up and say, do you know what, we're not going to do anything like start charging you money for repositories with an E in their name, right? You'd go, well, okay, you say you're not going to, and I probably believe you because you seem like decent people, but we can't stop you. But if they were to say, and if we did that, someone could take this code and run it themselves. Does that not make that argument more compelling? It's more honest, I think, to be able to make that case.
I think it's an intellectual exercise. Because anyone, you know, yes, having there's different levels of assurances that you can provide, right? Like, so for example, being able to easily get data out of GitHub. So if GitHub goes bad, you can take that data and put it into GitLab or whatever else. That to me is very, very valid and very, very compelling. But the actual availability of the code itself in GitHub, I don't think is very interesting. Because most people, like if it's a code dump, most people are not going to have the ability or the skills to actually utilize that. So to me, like that is it's an intellectual benefit, but it's practically the same argument happened with Launchpad, right? Is people were blithering on for years about Launchpad being open source, and basically no one's used the
basically
code.
Basically, no one's used code.
So I think it definitely depends on what type of company you are, too, right? I think Canonical took so much heat for not open sourcing Launchpad because they advertise themselves as an open source company. So when an open source company right. doesn't open source something, the perception is going to be different. Where if you're a fully proprietary company, I think GitHub's another different example because they're an online service and those are perceived a lot differently than downloadable exactly. projects. Yep. So I think it depends what kind of company you are, what kind of project you are. Are you an online service? Are you there's so many variables there that it really depends on a lot of those different pieces coming together.
The reason I brought up the previous argument is because I think there is a central argument to this. When do you open source? Which is, assume you're a company now, right? The basic argument here is you say, okay, what's the value to us of a community and having people participate in this thing and building this wider community out? What does that give to us versus how much effort is it to open source? And then you add those two up in dollars and you say, well, whichever one's bigger will do that. And I think everyone basically agrees on that, right? Every time the question should be open source is done, that's presented as basically the only argument that needs making. And I think it is the majority of the argument, but I'd like to explore some of the more outlying reasons why, what might influence that decision beyond just what's the value of a community versus what's the value of lock-in. Essentially,
but that's the thing. Like to me, in calculating the equation, so let's give an example, right? Let's imagine not something as big and as kind of wiry as GitHub, but let's take another non-open source. Let's say Skype. Okay, Skype is not open source. It's a service that lots of people use. It's something that Microsoft need to have on lots of different platforms so they don't rear the ugly head of the monopoly issue again. They want, like Microsoft, they're a different company these days. They're very much invested in open source compared to what they used to be like. So let's assume they're opening up the question of like, is it worth open sourcing Skype? To me, one of the most important things to assess is if we do open source this, how much are we happy with third-party developers changing this outside of our core strategy? So Microsoft will build strategic goals for Skype, and if somebody comes in and says, we want to do something differently, or we want to add a feature that we don't care about, or that Microsoft doesn't care about, how open to that are we? And then secondly, how much are we willing to invest in growing the community around Skype? So are we willing to hire community managers and developer evangelists and build infrastructure and all these different pieces that go into that?
I think,
and to me, bear with me, the level of investment and the level you care about that should influence how much you open source something.
I think I'd quibble with your first point, but it's a quibble rather than a disagreement. I don't think when Microsoft is saying should be open source Skype, they're worried about external third parties adding features that Microsoft don't want. I think they're worried about Microsoft adding features that external developers don't want and patching it back out. It's because if an external developer builds a thing which allows Skype to, I don't know, talk to Ubuntu phones or send video where otherwise it wouldn't do, or talk to your 3D printer or something, they just have to not accept the patch. What I think companies in that situation are worried about is they say, okay, we're going to now insist that you use this emoji set, or that you have to join your contacts list to this in order to talk to anybody. And people go, we don't want that, and patch it out. They're worried about not being able to do user hostile stuff, essentially. It's that's why I think lack of control comes up in the discussion. It's not because people might write loads of great stuff that you decide you don't want. It's because you write loads of evil stuff that they don't want.
I'm not sure if that's that big of a deal.
Is there a precedent for that you're thinking of? Because like everything's open source in Ubuntu, right? And everyone, in the downloadable product, and everyone is an exaggeration. Many people complained about Scopes contacting Ubuntu Canonical servers. Did anyone ever make a package that changed Scopes and try to get it adopted in any reasonable manner that it did?
That's what Fix Ubuntu was.
And how popular was it? Among users.
People who thought talking to Canonical servers was a bad idea, very popular, and people are still to this day saying, oh, you see, Ubuntu ships all their stuff off because it's spyware. Go to fixubuntu.com to fix that. Yeah. So, yeah, there's an example. You look at something like WhatsApp, it's difficult to find out exactly why they won't open things and why they DMCA third-party implementations and reverse-engineered clients out of existence. But the prevailing opinion is because they're not interested. They want to be able to exercise control over the direction of the protocol. And realistically, the only reason to do that is because you're worried someone might not implement the things that you've done.
I think they want to monetize the product. And if everyone's using a third-party client, WhatsApp gets none of the money. So that one's an easy one to figure out.
I don't think that's true at all, because you've still got to connect to the WhatsApp servers, at which point they just charge you money for it. Done. Everyone's a winner. You're not locked out from monetization. What you are locked out from is... The perfect example here is third-party Twitter clients. Twitter have introduced a bunch of new features which just don't show up in third-party clients. Things like multi-person DMs, right? Most third-party Twitter clients don't support multi-person DMs yet. Now, I think most of those client implementers would say, oh yeah, that's because we haven't got around to it yet. But things like Twitter-sponsored posts and so on, they don't show up in third-party clients either. And that's and they're never going to get implemented in third-party clients, because the third-party developers are going to say, why the hell would I want to put Twitter's ads in my product? But Twitter are like, we don't want you to be able to patch our ads out. That's how we pay for Twitter. So it's that kind of control where they're doing things which are, again, this is the dichotomy between good for the company and good for the users. What users want is everything completely for free, and what the company want is people to pay for stuff.
Well, I think we're talking kind of about the same thing, right? Which is the hardest thing to determine when you open source something, or when you, even if you don't open source something, if you just start a project that is open source, is getting the balance right where people can see value in the project from different perspectives. And so, you know, we use Red Hat as an example earlier on, or rather that Tobias used Red Hat as an example earlier on. Red Hat's been very successful with their open source. And I think part of the reason for that is because a lot of what Red Hat works on are infrastructure pieces.
Right.
So these are pieces that sit at the bottom or towards the bottom of the stack, where you put it in place and off you go. And the value you build is on top of it. This is something the Linux Foundation talk about, right? Is that you put together 70% of what you've got is open source, and then you build your web app that sits on top of that. And the challenge, I think, is if you work, and this is something I think Canonical face with, for example, Unity, where Unity is kind of the jewel in the Ubuntu offering. And if other people want to twist and contort that into a different thing, when that is the jewel in the offering for Canonical, then you get this imbalance in the force, right? So, you know, with other things like Upstart, for example, was a pretty healthy open source project. Not a lot of issues with that. But with something that's much more visible at the center of it, it's quite different. And that's why maybe the example of Skype is a poor example, because I can imagine Microsoft having the same issues that Canonical had with Unity, with Skype, but with another project that's an infrastructure piece, it's not the same. So I'd say, like, in assessing whether you open source something, it's really how can you still accomplish the things that you want to accomplish reasonably and realistically? Because if you want to make money directly from something, or you're looking at scarcity if you want to be the only company that's distributing something, then it's going to be very difficult to do that in an open source setting without inherently restricting people.
There is, I think, I was going to say there's a question of, if you open source stuff, then you are obliged to do things properly. I think some of the motivation behind you should open source this, let me pick an example. So let's imagine that you've got a game and that game gives you achievements, right? And right. you open source the client, and your question then becomes, well, what stops someone just patching the client? So it says you've collected 1,000 stars when you haven't, so you get the 1,000 stars achievement. To which the security person's response correctly is, well, you need to validate all that stuff on the server, which is true. However, you can not open source the thing, have that in the client, and then it's much harder to do that. Now, security people will say someone will eventually manage to reverse engineer your client and work out how to do that, and that's why you have to do it on the server. But if your game's only going to be around for a year, then maybe you get enough time by just closed sourcing both halves that you can do things in a less perfect but more easily achievable way and get away with it, which you can't do if you're open source.
Right. That to me is like the complexity, right? Is just it's getting that balance right. And well, the thing that I think we often forget as people who've been involved in open source for years is there's so much intrinsic knowledge in figuring this stuff out, because it really is the balance between like what can you technically achieve, what can you achieve with people, and there will be some people in the world that think, ah, you know, yeah, I'll just put a CLA in place, thinking whatever, it's just a detail, not realizing that that will be a massive decision for some people. In like, some people can't sign them, some people don't like them, some people are okay with them, you know. And I think that's the challenge. Like, do we think that there is a could you condense down into 5 steps, like a flowchart, like this is the reason why you should open source something or not? Because I'm not sure if you can.
I think there's too many variables to make it that simple.
So yeah,
yeah. No, I,
so I don't know.
It's complicated. Like saying, okay, you need a flowchart saying, should I set up a company to do this? Could you produce a 5-step flowchart which purported to answer that question? Yes. Would it actually answer that question? No, it wouldn't.
Yeah. So I guess we have an ultimately unsatisfying conclusion to bias, which is don't know.
It depends. So, yeah. But I think, yeah, I think anyone who was asked to address this question would start their explanation with, well, it's complicated and dependent on exactly your situation and there are no hard and fast rules. And 15 minutes later, it turns out that it's complicated and it depends on your situation and there are no hard and fast rules. But hopefully that may enlighten you on some of the thinking that goes into that decision.
One thing that might be a fun segment for us to do in the future is people can email us and say, you know, should company X open source product Y? And then we'll dip into it for, you know, just like, yeah, we'll have a chat about that. Because I'm not sure that we all will see it from the same angle, which is what we look for in a bad voyage segment. So
sure. That would be interesting.
Let us know if there's a project or a product or whatever that you think, you know, you'd like to hear our opinion on whether that should be open source. Drop us an email to show at badvoltage.org. There we have it. Another show. No, Brian. It's always weird when Brian's not here because I think he adds a certain amount of irreverence, which is a very nice way of saying random, non-factual bollocks. But
intemperate shouting and rhetoric. No, I think that's terribly unfair. There are a bunch of discussions where the three of us tend to end up on one side and Brian ends up on the other.
Yeah.
Whether that's because, you know, we're sensible and he's mental, or probably more accurately because we're a terrible echo chamber hive mind and he's actually speaking truth to power, is worthy of discussion. The snappy and flatback thing, I mean, to my mind, what I want to see is a good bad voltage discussion on the forums and then bleeding into the next show. Right. Where we can do it without shouting at people. Because it seems like there's an interesting discussion to have there, but you can't get into that interesting discussion because everyone just hurls abuse at one another. It's just like System D versus everything that isn't System D, or like Mir versus Wayland or whatever. And
yeah,
I'd like to get into the tech of it a bit rather than saying, oh, no, I'm not going to use that because they lied about it. It's just so annoying.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. That there's good on all sides of the debate, in my mind. And the thing I'm excited about with Snappy and Flatpak is that these problems are being solved because we've been dealing this with for years in Linux. I mean, it's been a freaking nightmare to get stuff packaged up in this modern era of
at which point now it's going to be easy to package as a Snap and as a Flatpak and as an app image and out of the frying pan into the very same identical frying pan. I'm not sure this actually buys us anything.
I'm pretty sure that because we can't set a standard for Snappy and Flatpak, we will therefore produce another standard, which is going to be Snappy Pack. The Snappy Pack format is going to...
At least this frying pan is going to be sandboxed.
I think even if there are just as many packaging systems as there are today, and they are just as incompatible as they are today, each one is still materially better than today's state of the art. As Jerry says, you get sandboxing. Hooray. So,
this is true.
I think, interesting times ahead, I think. But... Only someone genuinely politically obsessed would draw a parallel between everyone eating their own young rather than coming together with Snappy and Flatpak and people doing the same thing with Brexit. but I have noticed a certain amount of tragic similarity between the UK political situation and the last 20 years of open source. I have to admit it.
It is a bit scary, isn't it? It's very similar. So
I don't know. You know,
I mean, people just need to get on is the thing that bothers me. Like, I wrote this rant on Facebook last week. It's just like, can't we just stop, like, taking one hardened position? It bothers me. It bothers me. Like, I see this all the time.
Wouldn't it be nice if everyone was nice? And the answer is yes, it would. Well done. But you need a stage two in your plan.
It's not even just that. It's not even just that. It's like, wouldn't it be nice if somebody could just have empathy with somebody else's perspective for once, right? Like, right. There are people who are very liberal. There are people who are very conservative. Both of those people have perfectly fine viewpoints. Why can't they look at each other instead of just looking at themselves? And it's just, anyway. It bothers me.
I'm feeling a very strong urge of step one, steel underpants. Step two, line of question marks. Step three, profit. I gotta tell you. Jono's underpants gnomes theory of political philosophy. But yes,
it's Jono's philosophy of just people being normal human beings. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking about this. I'm going to fade into the ether.
We should fade into the ether. We are interested in your thoughts on all this stuff because all of the things we've talked about here are kind of big open questions. And
yes.
And speaking purely for myself, it never hurts to get more people's viewpoints. You know, get it? There is no way I can be harmed by having other people come in and say, I think this, and adding to my store of knowledge on the subject. So please do chip in on any of the things we talked about, either email show@badvoltage.org or go to community.badvoltage.org and post on our forum about it. And we'll see you on the next show.